This episode of Creativity in Captivity is sponsored by the Curtis Theater in Brea, California, presenting Don Reed's The Never Too Late Show on Saturday, May 11th. Tickets are available at the Curtis Theater website. Get ready for insight and inspiration on the creative process from an array of artists, writers, and visionaries on May 9th, when Season 7 of Creativity in Captivity kicks off. In the meantime, please enjoy over 150 episodes hosted by Pat Hazel with a stable of creative guests in our listening lounge at creativityincaptivity.fun.
This is Creativity in Captivity. I'm Pat Hazel. Today, we focus on celebrating poetry in all its forms, with poems being showcased by Sean Patrick Mulroy, Scott Woods, Deb Carpenter-Nolte, Aaliyah American Horse, Nicole Laffer, Denise Duhamel, and Mighty Mike McGee. Our special poetry guide through this episode has 5 published books of poems, is the recipient of a Pushcart Prize, and he's the Nebraska State Poet. Coming up is our tour guide through a pantheon of poetry, Mr. Matt Mason.
That spark of electricity, a skipping stone that sets you free, or captive to a mystery, the curse of creativity. La 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 la. La 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 la.
Thank you, Pat.
I tried to use some alliteration there just to.
I like being your Sherpa guide.
A Sherpa guide takes people to the top of Everest, and in some ways, poetry feels like a cliffhanger in the world right now, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. I think poetry's been woven into something that's difficult to understand rather than what it was for ages, which was a way of telling stories and histories.
Well, and poetry, it uses words to create pictures, sounds, feelings, and so it has its own sound, form, image, rhythm. But I think there's an intimidation that's come over poetry, don't you think? A little like Shakespeare?
About 100 years ago, maybe a little more, it became about forming a style of poetry which was difficult and hard to understand, but was impressive to critics. But before that, people would share poems in kitchens and memorize poems and read a book of poems for fun. It's coming back to that, but poetry is meant to connect people.
Well, I'm so impressed with Amanda Gorman coming on the scene, because here's a young contemporary voice shining lights on lots of subjects, but it's like a celebrity moment for poetry, for somebody like that to be able to speak at a Super Bowl game or a presidential inauguration.
Yeah, it's also kind of stunning to see her do such an amazing job at the presidential inauguration and then see a lot of indignant response online of poetry trolls of like, that poem won't be relevant in 10 years. It's like, well, you know, it was written for today, so shut up.
By the way, I like the voice you chose there. I like the the snooty critic voice. That's a good one.
It is my snooty poetry critic voice.
Yes. Well, I think we'll be hearing more of that as we speak today. How do you define poetry? Like, if you're teaching or overseeing a writer's clinic, how do you liberate folks to feel comfortable writing and reading poetry?
Oh, well, I love going in and talking to people and just breaking down the fact that anyone can write a poem. Anyone can write a good poem. Maybe it's relevant only to you, but if you can capture a feeling that you're feeling and put it on paper in a way that if you pull that poem out in 3 years and you can feel that same way, you've done it. You've done it right. I've got a lot of poems I wrote in high school that I'm not going to show another human being because they're not terribly well written, but I feel the feelings I had at those moments. It brings it back. And I think that's what it is. It's kind of a time capsule for a story, for a feeling, for an attitude, something you want to record and make somebody else feel.
I've always thought of it as a universal truth in that poem's moment, whatever that is. If it's revenge, if it's unrequited love, you know, it's almost like the early century TED talk. Here's something I want to shine a light on, and these are my feelings on this topic.
Former Nebraska State poet Bill Clefcorn defined a poem as an attitude looking for something solid to sit down on. A poem is an attitude, a feeling, and finding those solid words or descriptions or details that make it something that someone else can understand and feel.
Tell me the difference between poems meant to be read, meaning by the reader themselves on the page, versus things that are read for performance in more of a spoken word, because there's a dynamic factor of how it's read to you.
I think something that's good on the page can be good on the stage. Something that's good out loud can be good on paper also. So I really look for poems to be able to do both. And part of that's hard because poets aren't trained as actors or public speakers necessarily. But I mean, that said too, out loud, you'll see poems with sound effects and voices. Some poets are pretty dynamic in how they deliver. You know, there's a poet, Mike McGee, in the Bay Area, who's got a poem with like 30 seconds of whale song in it. You never know what you can get if you go out to a poetry reading. It's just kind of poetry wearing different clothes, whether it's on the page or out loud, but hopefully it looks sharp both ways.
I would think that the ones that you would want to see on the page are ones where they actually create imagery with the words, maybe how the poem is laid out, and if it's a circle or if it's cut, some strange indent, or where there's an intention that sun-dappled creek, the words are flowing like the creek. That can't be captured read over the radio.
Yeah, it's a little tougher. But I also think sometimes a poem, if you see it on the page and you hear the poet read it out loud, you can see why they have certain indents or why they break the lines at certain phases, because that's how they read it. And they're trying to record their voice somehow on paper using the white space and the line breaks and all that.
So in lieu of an ellipses or something, they're putting a pause in there. And how about the poets that choose to say, do no capitalization? What do you think the intent is? And I'm naively asking this question, but
I've heard poems described as a way of writing where there are no rules. And I completely disagree. I think poetry has all the rules of journalism, fiction, all that. But it's got one extra rule, which is break those rules. When you break a rule in writing, there's an effect. There's a little atom that's been split. So if you choose not to use punctuation, that does something to a reader's brain and eyes. You know, we see ourselves reading it faster or rushing things together a little bit. So it's figuring out what the rules are and what the rules add to writing so that you know when you break them, what happens.
Well, Leonardo da Vinci said that painting is poetry that is seen rather than felt, and poetry is painting that is felt rather than seen.
I like that a lot.
The funny thing is people say, I don't like poetry, and yet they like rap music, which is poetry.
That's because you like rap music, and we've been taught to dislike poetry. So if there's a form of poetry we like, it can't be poetry.
I see.
When I was in high school, I would tell people, I hate poetry. And then I'd go off with my friends, and we'd be debating different Pink Floyd lyrics, or which is best. And it's like, that's poetry.
Right. It is interesting, the expression. And so many lyricists are really great poets.
Oh, God, yes. God, yes. And some are not as good, which is why music is awesome, because you've got guitar and keyboard to cover up the fact that your lyrics kind of are lame.
I'm thinking about a Stephen Sondheim, who uses hard rhymes and resolves comedic moments and has character things that unfold, because there's a narrative in a musical where it's not the same as a pop song where you can use soft rhymes, and it's definitely created on a poem, a structure of poetry.
It is a poem. There are so many different kinds of poems and genres of poems that sometimes we lose sight because we want poems to be one thing. And unfortunately, usually that one thing is what we were taught in high school a poem is, which for most people is not something exciting.
Well, and even prose confuses people because of it not rhyming in the same way.
Yeah.
The pros and cons of prose.
Ooh, You had to go there.
I have been paying attention to your poetry for some time because of your being from Nebraska and knowing your sister, who's been a big supporter of me in terms of production and camera work and so forth. But not too long ago, you had a book called At the Corner of Fantasy in Maine, and the subtitle was Disneyland, Midlife, and Churros. And it was a whole slew of poems about different times in your life that you made treks to Disneyland, planned it, were going. So tell me about the inspiration for this book, and also just give people an overview of what you were trying to do from cover to cover.
This was by far the strangest poetry project I ever started, and it's probably my favorite, just because I basically woke up one day, 49 years old, and found myself thinking about Disneyland, and then started subscribing to podcasts and reading articles and reading books and doing all this research on Disneyland, and didn't know why, didn't know what was happening. It was like a bad midlife crisis episode of a dumb sitcom. My wife is a poet, Sarah McKinstry Brown, and she saw this going on and said, "What are you writing?" And I'm like, "I'm not writing. This is dumb." And she's like, "You're a writer. You're doing research. So write." So I started writing, and in the whole process of writing these poems, started writing a poem about Space Mountain or a different ride. And then it got deeper and deeper until I find out I'm really writing about this place that is a touchstone for different parts of my life. I went there when I was a little kid with my parents, when I was in college. And then after my mom passed away, the first place I took my family, all four of us went to Disneyland. So all these major parts of my life intersect there. And I was kind of writing a book about my parents passing away in a really weird outside way that I'm grateful for poetry because it helped me figure that out.
When they talk about your life passing in front of you before you go, but in this case, it was passing in front of you in the form of each of those trips. I think about that in regard to things like Coca-Cola commercials and other things, that there are things about going to the drive-in or going places that are deep emotional moments in their life. And advertisers have been very good about co-opting that in their commercials. But Disneyland is an invitation in transition from when you were a son to when you were a father taking your kid. So it is definitely a very interesting point of view. And in fact, if I could engage you in reading something from the book, near the end here, you have something called What You Find at Disneyland Is. This can both tell them a little bit about what your view of Disneyland is and give us a sample of poetry right off the top.
You got it. What You Find at Disneyland Is. That when you came here on a trip by yourself and investigate why you can't stop thinking about the place and had thought maybe it was the park itself and Walt and all his stories, is that you were wrong, and you're here because of you and all the stories you've been part of on trips made here in past years to this cheerful once upon an orange grove. And it's like pulling out boxes from the basement and trying to fit into clothes from different ages of your life, and you can't, with them small or faded or so brittle they splinter apart like straw or just out of fashion, because you can't be 4 or 25 or 46 ever again. You have to walk with one stiff elbow, the toe and heels that hurt, all these small pains that now take ages to soothe. You can't change any of this. Except maybe that gut. But man, you've come to exactly the wrong place for that when there are churro carts, peanut butter dipped in chocolate, 1,000 sweet things shaped like Mickey Mouse's head. There is a legendary sandwich you find to be ham and cheese wedged inside of something more funnel cake than bread. You came here to ride Space Mountain and find answers. But the answers aren't on roller coasters. They're in the rhythm of your body's aches as you hike up Disneyland Drive, thinking about trips with your daughters, wife, parents, friends you find yourself walking without here in the middle of your life, halfway to the next. Don't you dare waste a breath.
I know that you have a fetish for churros. You asked me to write a blurb for the back of the book. And after I had read it, I shared that I thought it was at the crossroads of Disney and Whitman. It was a page-turning poetry that is walt-to-walt nostalgia sprinkled with cinnamon sugared fairy dust because I couldn't get the churro flavor out of my head. And then jokingly, I said to you, you should make the bookmark a churro. And before I knew it, I was getting bookmarks from your publisher in the mail that had the churro on one side and the info on the book on the other. And that made me laugh so much.
Writing a poem is an act of translation, of taking the things we're feeling, with feelings, attitudes, whatever, and finding words for them in language, which, you know, every language is different and every language is insufficient in different ways. And you still got to work with it and try to make somebody else feel what you're feeling.
Regardless of how long a poem is, there's an end to the ride.
Yeah, you'll get book-length poems and all, but not too many. They're meant to be brief.
Let's talk about different kind of ways that poetry presents itself.
I love that poetry is doing so many different things, especially in culture right now. There's some folks who are using poetry as a form of storytelling, especially, you know, on the spoken word stages and keeping history. But I love the traditional forms, you know, sonnets and villanelles, which work with certain rhyme schemes, sometimes certain repetition patterns, haiku, which are basically a poem in one breath. So many different ways of looking at it, but they're all poems. There's not one kind of poem that we should all be saying, yo, everything should be a sonnet and everything else is trash. Or no, it should be this difficult thing that no one can understand. Everything else is horrible.
Yes. I like the crowd now, the upheaval of the crowd against poetry here.
Exactly.
We mean there are torches and pitchforks against it. Well, the kind that's interesting to me, again, fellow Nebraskan, but Johnny Carson used to have the cowboy poets on frequently. And is there a model for that? Is there a poems that you read to your horse, or what defines cowboy poetry?
You know, cowboy poetry is just fantastic in that it's storytelling. It's usually about working on a ranch, working on a farm. It's usually in rhymed couplets, and it's a great storytelling form. I'd love to see a concert with rap artists and cowboy poets. I mean, they're using the same form, but with different rhythms.
It'd be nice to see those rappers sitting around the fire too.
Yeah.
Out there with a plate of beans. You told me about a poet named Deborah Carpenter Nolting. Is this somebody you've worked with?
Yes. I've read a couple times with Deb. She's fantastic. She's published books. She's published CDs. She's toured all over with cowboy poetry and is a stunning storyteller with that.
Well, let's welcome Deb Carpenter Nolting to the program here. What designates something as cowboy poetry?
To me, I guess it means that it's sort of in the Western genre, where people talk about people of the West, and it can go back, in my opinion, as far back as people settling the West, and beyond that, people, the indigenous people who were here before we traveled the West and took over the West. It can be day-to-day things, people taking care of the land, of the animals, and just, I guess it's got a broad spectrum in my perspective. I think it can encompass a lot of different things.
What influenced you to begin to create your own cowboy poetry?
Well, I started songwriting when I was in high school, and my guitar was just a great comfort to me throughout high school and college. And then I married and had a family and started doing some kind of, you know, contest singing and that kind of thing. And really the only venue for my kind of music, which is folk music in my area, was kind of the bar scene, or, you know, there really wasn't a place to plug in and play.
I'd love it if you could share with me some of your original work. You said that you would be playing for us Everything Goes in a Circle. Do you want to set that up?
Okay. This is a piece about Mari Sandoz, just honoring her work. She's a Nebraska author. She grew up in the Sand Hills. I guess we have a lot of things in common. So I really like her work. She's one of those writers that just brought the true West out to, rather than a romanticized version of it. And so this just talks about her advocacy, I guess, basically for Native Americans before that was a popular thing in the West. It talks about her father's apple orchard and I guess her love song to the plains. And so it's basically about the plains that she loved so much and that we all love so much.
Okay, here now is Everything Goes in a Circle by Deb Carpenter-Nolte. Very nice. Now, why is that not called cowgirl poetry?
Well, I think it's kind of like actors today. We don't say actors and actresses anymore. And cowboy encompasses a lot of different kinds of feelings.
I gotcha. I'm just trying to be more open-minded. To find out more about Deb's poetry, you can go to debcarpenternolting.com.
Okay. Thank you so much, Pat.
When you're writing of home and of community, attention to detail is what impresses me. You mentioned Scott Woods, who writes a lot about the Columbus, Ohio era.
If you can find the right details, that's what can really bring a poem to life. Because otherwise, you're saying things that other people fill in with whatever's in their own heads. But if you give a reader, a listener, the details that this poem is sitting on, then they are in your experience rather than in something they fill in. And one of the best of these is Scott Woods, who's writing about Columbus, Ohio. He's writing about Prince. He might be ranting about Stephen King. I mean, he is just someone who is just a genius out there working in poetry and essays and so much.
I am here with poet Scott Woods. Scott, are you in Columbus, Ohio, or is just that where you grew up?
Both. I'm still here.
Okay. And you are a librarian in Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, among other things. But yeah, mostly a librarian for about 27 years.
And does that come above or below being a poet?
In terms of pay or love?
Your identity.
I suppose just below these days.
What is the life of a poet like?
Once you clock out of the job that gives you benefits, that looks like a lot of reading and a lot of scheduling of gigs and that kind of thing so that people know that you're actually doing the thing.
Matt and I talked a lot about nostalgia, and it sounds to me like your love and awareness of all things Columbus, Ohio comes out in the writing that you do.
Yeah, I would say place is very important to what I'm doing, even if I'm not really name-checking Columbus a lot. And I think this is true for most poets, whether they want to admit it or not. You know, without place, we're almost nothing.
And how about community? Because he did identify you as quite a good community poet.
Well, that is the bedrock of pretty much any endeavor that I'm doing. As the owner of an arts-based nonprofit, Streetlight Guild, as someone who puts together and produces events of many artistic disciplines, and as someone who spends no small amount of time critiquing the culture of my city, community is almost the only thing that protects me pretty much at all times. It's not just an audience for me. It's a shield. It's how I make my living.
And gathering really allows for expression, doesn't it?
It does. And I think, you know, to get to the best version of what you create, you have to be as free as possible. And so if people are willing to sustain you and be there for your events and just share your stuff all the time, like, I have an incredible base of support, and that just makes my art better.
Awesome. Well, I'd like you to share some of your art. You told me that you're going to share a poem called "Any Poet Who Says No Is a Liar."
Yeah. Normally I wouldn't introduce a poem, but this one has a funny story. So I wrote this in the library during a meeting that I knew was going to go nowhere and require no real attention from me. And so I said, well, since we're here, I'll write this poem. Prior to the meeting, a coworker had just asked me a question. They were embroiled in a discussion about old relationships and regret. And one of them turned to me and said, "Scott, have you ever had your heart broken?" And I was like, "Have you ever read any of my poetry?" So I wrote this poem in the meeting on the heels of that conversation. "Have you ever had your heart broken?" she asked, knowing the answer. "And I'm on it before the question mark hits the air. I have stitched my loves across every entrance, petals dropped from the budding embouchure of every kiss lining the doorways into me like pinched salt spells. Whispers pool in bottle tree sigils I keep like a wine cellar in the sun. Each a chamber to a stilled heart that remembers how I took every limb for my own, every whistling regret an anthem, to a country found in their leaving laughter, a refugee on every tongue. I scaled their sighs, climbing into their mouths with my broken animal ways, having the nerve to be angry when they spit me into the curling dust. A heartbroken poet is redundant, which is to say, follow the balled up odes that only hit their mark after the leaving, when I remember the taste of jambalaya kisses on her neck, the soap smell of her thigh, the great morning after omelet debate of 2016, the lifting hug, the quickened hush thrust, the rasp of tongue that knows me better than anyone ever again. If it were not for the piercing between my ribs, I might mistake this for ecstasy. If it were not for the poetry, I might mistake her for a religion, her memory a holy ghost, her lap a heaven of redacted love songs, her kiss a terrifying and final revelation."
Wow, that is some sense memory. My heart is broken listening to your heart being broken.
Well, it was a long meeting.
I gather your mind strayed into something very, very important and personal. And I think that's what makes it so universal for people.
Thank you.
To find out more about Scott Woods, go to scottwoodswrites.net and you can dive a little deeper into his heart and his humanity. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you so much.
You mentioned Sean Patrick Mulroy as somebody who was great at and enjoyed form poetry. And what does that mean exactly?
with form poetry, it's about using the traditions and kind of making them your own also. Because there are traditions like sonnets and villanelles and sestinas and ghazals and all these different kinds of forms that have a formula to them. But when we bring it into the modern age, you know, we're using those forms and we're looking at what we can do to them. And Sean Patrick Mulroy is a poet who has been doing this really beautifully of taking these forms for a poem that I think, oh yeah, I know this form. And then you read it and it's like, wait a minute, what was that? That's not exactly what I expected. I love seeing people really bringing creative elements to the traditions. It makes us echo something from a past time, but it also updates it, which is a great way to getting points across.
Okay, we are joined now by poet Sean Patrick Mulroy. And where are you coming from?
I'm dialing in from New York City today.
Excellent. Tell me about how poetry infiltrated your life.
So I started out as a musician. I was a singer and a songwriter. I really came into poetry through performance because when my band broke up, I had a really awesome friend who went to a school near Boston where I had recently dropped out of Berklee College of Music. And she went to Wellesley and she took me to a poetry slam and I'd never really seen one as an adult. I was like kind of interested, but it didn't quite grab me. But then I went a second time and the second time, for whatever reason, it grabbed me. It was an opportunity to perform and be on stage, which I didn't have because my band had broken up and I was kind of trying to figure out my next move. Most of my songs were written on piano, so it was very difficult to gig because back in those days, keyboards were either punishingly expensive or like not very soulful instruments. So it was difficult for me to play live. And so having the opportunity to perform, I had always like written poetry the way that people on an airplane will tell you they write poetry, you know, like, oh yeah, I write poetry too, like in a journal. And I had like read it a little bit in high school, like what you might expect like a young gay guy to read, like I guess like Anne Sexton, you know, things like that. In terms of actually beginning to write it seriously, that was definitely my early 20s. And I had come to this poetry slam and wanted to get better at it because the people who were there were interesting and funny. And I basically came into poetry through poets, I guess, because like I really enjoyed their company and I wanted to be cool to them.
In a way, you were a lyricist who didn't have a band initially, right? And so by stripping that away, you were attracted to performance, to slams and spoken word, as opposed to being somebody that was thinking about printed matter.
It's kind of a joke because I feel like musicians are often very bad poets, especially if you look at like popular musicians. And I think in my case, like I started out rather bad. And then through kind of a lot of people encouraging me and like working really, really, really hard, now I think I'm like passable.
Well, listen, poetry is not like cliff diving, right? You can be bad for a while in poetry and then have an aha or find your voice or find your subject matter. Because it's about universal truths. It's about having a message to share or express. Sometimes as we find our identity, we also find our words.
One of the nice things about poetry, unlike basically every other art form that I know of, I don't know about studio art, but certainly any other kind of performance art, the older you get, the better you get at it. I haven't encountered a musician whose like late career work inspired me as much as their early career work. And that was always something I was worried about. Working in music. So one of the nice things about poetry is you don't have to worry about that because you kind of mature at the same time as your art.
As well as the spoken word, as the performer, you have captured your words in a book called Hated for the Gods. So I'm wondering if you'll select a piece from that to share with us today.
Absolutely. This piece is called Podvig, which is a Russian word. Podvig is a word for like a great achievement. And it's dedicated to this guy, Maxim Lapinov. There was a series of internment camps for gay men in Eastern Europe, Western Russia, in Chechnya. He escaped and then went through a series of travails with the government and basically had to flee the country with his partner and his family. And they threatened his extended family. So like everyone he knew and loved had to like go into hiding because of these people trying to trace him down. And he got everyone to safety with like the help of an underground like queer Underground Railroad kind of situation called the Rainbow Road. And then he went back to Russia, back into danger, specifically so he could in person file a complaint with the Russian government about the treatment he had endured. And like, it was one of those things where it was just so they could no longer deny it by virtue of no one had come forward. They still didn't do anything, of course, but like, and there's just so few people, in my opinion, heroic. And this is a guy who literally his business was selling balloon animals, and he just wasn't going to let this go. And I just have such a tremendous admiration for him. So I wrote this poem for him, which I very rarely get to perform because it requires such an explanation.
The explanation may be longer than the poem, but this is Sean Patrick Mulroy with the poem Podvig from his book, Hated for the Gods.
Podvig, for Maxim Lapinoff, I hope you will forgive me my devotion. Impotent, a pinprick twisted into useless rage on your behalf at cocktail parties thrown for academics, drunk on their American Pushlust. How I would bring the cities of their courtesy to ruin, but inevitably someone cuts me off to change the subject. History is what a culture tells itself when rising from the charred page of a war to burst luxuriant with poetry and song again. Astonishing to watch our countrymen pretend they cannot hear the music of our people even as they dance to it. A miracle. How still we toil in the service of our nation's joys to be paid with such silence. Hero. Thank you for refusing them their favorite currency. Thank you, trading safety for the truth before the jeweled eyes of the same world swarming with batons the last day that you stood outside a honey festival to sell balloons to children. Rows of market stalls stacked high with sweetness incorruptible as it is stolen. This, the more renowned fruit of an insect needed most to midwife flowers. Nothing blooms without them. Nothing will bear fruit. First there is no color, then no life at all. These two vanish all the more each day from field and headline both.
That's the voice of Sean Patrick Mulroy. And to find out more about his poetry, you can go to thevanishingman.com. Thank you so much, Sean Patrick, for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Another activist poet is Aaliyah American Horse. And this is a young Nebraska Youth Poet Laureate.
Yeah.
And so this must be somebody that you work closely with.
Yeah, this is someone I've read a few times with here in Nebraska. She was named Youth Poet Laureate of the state, but she was also named the Midwest Poet Laureate and is in group of four poets. One of them is going to be the next United States Youth Poet Laureate.
I now have the pleasure to speak with Aaliyah American Horse. And I want to know a little bit from you about how you came to poetry in the first place. Like, what was the draw into writing?
Well, I have to say that I've always been an artist and writer in some type of way. Growing up, I'd write songs, and I was actually in a band, not really a band, in middle school, but we liked to write songs and perform them. And those songs slowly just turned into poems, and eventually, one day in English, I was writing a poem, and my English teacher came up to me, and I was supposed to be doing something else. And she took that poem from me, and then she actually read it, and she's like, this is kind of a good poem, so I'm not going to get mad at you. And eventually, Zadika and Matt and some other poets came to my high school, and they did a performance, and they invited us to an open mic that night. So I went to the open mic, and I performed a poem, and I guess they took a liking to me. And that's kind of what led me to be here now.
Do you find yourself in those spoken word events being the youngest person most of the time?
At the beginning, yes. I was always the youngest person in the room and a lot of older folks at these events. But I've been going to these other events recently, like poetry slams and whatnot. And there's actually a lot younger students there, like high schoolers there. And I actually hosted an open mic here in Gordon, and we had someone as young as a freshman come up and do some poetry. So I think that's really cool.
So we're talking to Aaliyah in Gordon, Nebraska, and she writes on love, life, and spirituality. And Matt selected you because he liked your voice. And I understand that you are a nominee for the National Youth Poet Laureate and headed to Washington, D.C. To find out where you stand. That is extraordinary. Have you selected something for us today?
Yes, I have selected a poem that I actually put in my portfolio for nationals.
Okay, so here's Aaliyah American Horse with Contemporary Warriors.
I come from survivors, a family tree with rotted roots and broken branches, mended together through the uprise of a younger generation. Voices banging on wood from the inside, begging to be heard. We went from surviving off what Mother Earth, Unchi Makaa, allowed us to take, to living off whatever the newest and more corrupt politician wanted to give, who still expected us to drop to our knees in gratitude. Well, we are still living the same life we did 100 years ago. Our women being taken, raped, murdered, names unknown but stories said just to instill fear. An endless fight to feed our families and provide a roof that won't fall at a storm called colonization. Tongues chopped and shoved down our throats to stop us from speaking indigenous truth. The youth, just a piece of clay carved for this new world mold. Taught in schools to do this thing in this way, say this thing in this way, feel this thing in this way, be this person who you are not meant to be, leaving the stitches of your life just a memory. I was working as a waitress when an old cowboy came in. He complimented my beaded earrings and talked for nearly 2 hours about my culture, my family, the wars, what it means to be Native, and who I want to become. He said something that stood out. How on the reservation you'll find the car frames with every part, piece, and bolt stripped from it. He compared it to the hundreds of years ago where you would find buffalo bones, tatanka, with every bit of meat, piece, and skin stripped from it. See, my people, we have not changed but grown. The late generation charging into battle, leaving only the vision of a road we now have to walk upon. It's our job to tear down the overgrown weeds that block our view of the war, barricades put in place by ruling fists and residential schools. We are today's warriors. Our weapons are carved by our voices, fueled by a rage that was born in my mother and her mother and all the mothers before her. I want to find the hands who are responsible for the suffering of my nation, to force them to watch as we tear down what they have built, burn the walls built on our parents' backs, replace any essence of hate that spills out of the mouths who stand on the podium at the top of this nation. Their only issue ever being that their stack of money was too large for their house.
Well, that is a great salute to your heritage and the challenges that your people faced. I'm so happy that you shared it with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Well, we wish you continued success on that trip to Washington, D.C. To learn more about Midwest Youth Poet Laureate Aaliyah American Horse, go to Instagram at AMHRSE.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
I like the description you sent me in an email. This is poetry that makes you laugh and then punches you in the gut. I love when you can feel a range of emotions from laughter to pathos. Because to me, that's what's in a good musical or a good play or something is, you know, all the feels.
Yeah. Well, one of the books that changed what I saw what poetry could do was Denise's book called Kinky, which is a book about Barbie dolls, but it's from the perspective of someone who played with them and loved them as a kid and then grew up into a feminist to see the problems with the whole Barbie kind of approach. She wrote this book of poems that is just stunning because, yeah, it makes you laugh and then it slaps you across the face 3 lines later.
So joining us now is Denise Duhamel. How do you define yourself as a poet or your genre?
A lot of times I really like using social satire in my poetry as a way to get people laughing, to get them to think, as opposed to angry and rageful, and do that kind of poetry as well. But I feel like it's sort of off-putting, but I think social satire kind of lures people in.
It's like getting them to laugh and line up for a swine flu shot.
Exactly.
Now, you wrote a book called Kinky that is available on Amazon in hardcover. And I know that in that book, you wrote some material about Barbie. What was the context at that time? What were those poems about regarding Barbie?
So those poems were about, you know, racism, classism, American consumerism, right? Because a Barbie is just a vehicle to buy the camper and the clothes right. and the dream house. You can't just have a Barbie. You need to like everything else with it. So I was exploring issues of misogyny and also, strangely enough, plastic surgery, which has become, I was writing these poems in the early 90s, and I didn't know anyone with like lip injections or like right. Botox or anything. It was just this crazy thing. And I was thinking plastic surgery, Barbie's made of plastic, kind of the ideal, right? The ideal of womanhood, but she can't feel anything. She has no nipples. She has no genitalia to speak of, you know? So it's just like, she's beautiful and amazing, but can't even enjoy it.
That's interesting. And I know that the original woman that designed Barbie, part of making her an adult was so that little girls had something besides a doll to play with that was a baby. They could look forward to being mature. And a little girl driving a car, that was like future thinking for a kid.
Right, exactly. I mean, and I had that. So I was born in 1961 and Barbie was born in 1959, which we'll get to later because now she's 65 years old. And I remember really seeing her as an alternative to being a wife and mother and pushing a baby carriage. And we had dolls that actually came with like cloth diapers to
right.
and bottles and everything, right?
Now your poetry, many years later, that book is in its ninth printing and available on Amazon and Kindle, but you have now written a updated Barbie poem, which talks very much about Barbie's aging. I was fascinated when I read it. Here now with the poem called A Poem in Which Barbie Qualifies for Medicare is Denise Duhamel.
Barbie turned 65 on March 9th, 2024, and I wrote this poem. Poem in Which Barbie Qualifies for Medicare. Barbie never thought too much about her eligibility. She loved AARP, the discounts at Sunglass Hut and Outback Steakhouse when she waved her bright red card. She'd been born to shop, but the medical world was still a mystery to her. Sure, one of her first careers was as a registered nurse, and a decade later, she became an MD. But she had little experience being a patient, except when children made her a papier-mâché arm cast or shaved off her hair in play chemo. Without vertebrae or femur, Barbie never took a bone density test or had to worry about osteoporosis. Menopause had been a breeze, no hot flashes, no bleeding to miss. She was spotless when it came to age spots, even after all those years in the sun. No pee when she sneezed, no cataracts despite the fact she never blinked. She still drove at night, but was considering trading in her convertible for a cushy Lincoln town car to arrive in Medicare style for her annual checkups. She was looking forward to a ride in an MRI, then consulting a podiatrist to see if anyone could at last help ease her feet into New Balance sneakers. The dermatologist told her Botox was covered if Barbie suffered from migraines. Her smile had never given way to laugh lines or crow's feet. Still, Barbie lifted her hands to her temples and told a white lie. Why, yes, those headaches have sometimes been so fierce I've had to retreat into my dark box to rest. After all, Barbie was an American boomer, and she wanted her fair share, what she thought she deserved, what was coming to her.
I like that. I like the humor, and I like the reality. That's poet Denise Duhamel, and I thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Pat. It was fun.
Earlier, you mentioned Mike McGee, Mighty Mike McGee. Have you worked with him personally?
Yeah, I've traveled with Mike a little bit, and he's done shows in Omaha as he's passed through Nebraska, and we did a small tour together, and it's just such a pleasure to work with.
I guess as a comic, he also has a great sense of delivery. That's why he's winning these poetry slams. And
oh, yeah. Yeah, he's won international awards with his poetry and performance because he's got comic timing with the poems. The writing is so enjoyable. Mike McGee is someone who is just such a good writer and then a great deliverer. He will always leave you feeling good.
We are joined now by Mighty Mike McGee, who comes to us from San Jose, California, and started out in stand-up and made your way to a poetry slam in some strange invitation. So tell me how that turn happened.
In the late 90s, I would loiter in front of a coffee shop, and I had collected a mass group of friends. And having had gone through middle school and high school, being sort of bullied and teased, I decided, you know, I was going to become class clown. I made my way into it. I became class clown. And then I took that and being like, I'm going to be a funny person for the rest of my life. I'm going to be on stage for the rest of my life. I brought that to this coffee shop where I would just hang out with friends and make them laugh. And then another friend said, you know, you really should be doing this on stage somewhere. And I thought, nah, that's crazy. This is merely a hobby. And so that friend convinced me to go to an open mic in downtown San Jose. And I did stand up for the first time. It went very well. We brought all of our friends from that other coffee shop to a different coffee shop.
The classic first time of stand up is always that insurance policy of have the family and friends there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I brought 80 people with me. It was the biggest crowd they had seen for their open mic. And so they were excited, but they didn't like the fact that I was doing stand-up because I was the only one doing stand-up comedy. Everybody else was performing poetry and music. And so here I am trying to make people laugh with not the most PC material. I heard my friends get up and perform poetry for the first time. And I saw other people I didn't know, performing poetry, spoken word, performance poetry. I was dumbfounded. I thought, well, but isn't poetry supposed to be boring? Isn't it supposed to suck? And I found myself enjoying it thoroughly. And I thought, I didn't know poetry could be like this. And I am a performer. And I need a little bit of humor in my poetry. And I need a little bit of poetry in my humor. And I thought, maybe I can straddle both worlds and sort of pull them together. And so I tried it. So the next time I went, I signed up and I read a poem and it went over fine. And for the next couple of years, I did everything I could to just mesh poetry with humor. At some point, I stumbled across the term stand-up poetry. And that's what I've pretty much been doing ever since. And I got really heavily involved in poetry slams, which are basically open mics with a competitive format to them. And you get a short amount of time. You get about 3 minutes to perform a poem. I won some championships. I won some titles. And I sort of made a career as a poet. I became the poet laureate of Santa Clara County, which is all of San Jose and Silicon Valley. Who would have thought that a guy who hated poetry would end up making a life out of it?
There's a big difference, though, between the written word, and I know a poem should be able to stand on its own, but spoken word is kind of the Mountain Dew version of poetry.
It really is.
You have to be able to communicate something additional besides the words on the page.
Yes, but if you're lucky, it is the Baja Blast Mountain Dew of poetry. It is exciting. Right. It is uplifting. There's no question as to what someone might mean when they're performing a poem. It's not up to as much interpretation as what you might read on the page. But being able to take a poem from the page to the stage is a really potent skill.
It's like being your own docent at the museum, right? In front of your own art. I would love you to give us an example of your humor and being able to present it here with your voice. Will give everybody a real taste of the way you look at the world. You mentioned a poem named Like, L-I-K-E. And if you want to set that up, well, we'd love to hear it.
So this poem was something I wrote a number of years ago. I wrote it for a woman who I liked. And she probably knew I liked her, but I wanted to be able to state it. So I wrote it, and then I said, I have something I'd like to read you. I'm rarely nervous on stage, but this was an audience of one and an important audience at the time. And so I read this for her like this. I like you the way I like wonton packed full of shrimp, like too much syrup on my pancakes and in my beard, like blue whales like to say, those of you who don't speak whale, that was really dirty. I like you a whole bunch of a lot. You're a pocket full of awesome. I like you like Texans and pretty much only Texans like Texas. Like fat kids like cake. Like two likes three and four likes six because five has issues. Like tuna sandwiches like teeth. Like cherry-flavored Slurpees like to wash down convenience store nachos. Like couches like Sunday afternoon asses. I like you a whole bunch of a lot and a little bit more. You're a bottomless basket of extra crispy French fries covered in awesome sauce. I like you similar to the way pirates and frat boys like booty. Like newlyweds like honeymoons. Like David Copperfield likes performing grand scale yet lame-ass feats of illusion. Like the U.S. government likes performing grand scale yet lame-ass feats of illusion. Like testicles and friends like to hang. Like Americans like ranch dressing. Like Muppets like fisting. I like you a whole bunch of a lot and a whole lot more times infinity. And maybe that's starting to dip into the equation of love. Nevertheless, I got a thing for you. Like magnets got it for refrigerators. I'm stuck on you, and I like it. I like you an official metric buttload. I think you're a body full of soul, and I hope you like me back. Even if it's like dust likes furniture, at least you're all over me. I'm making a pledge, because I guess I'm just tired of meeting people who define themselves by what they don't like. I just don't like that. However, I do like holding you. Like the way your pillow holds your head when you sleep. Like PBS holds fundraisers. Like Irish, Mexican, and LGBTQ folks hold parades. Like the earth holds the moon and the sun holds the earth and how they'll constantly spin around each other forever. And even though that metaphor doesn't really make sense with regard to this poem, because that would imply that there were three of us, which would also be awesome. You get the idea. In my book, you rock and I like rocks. Anyhow, just because I spent an hour or so writing this down doesn't mean you have to like me back. But damn it, I would really, really like that.
I'm dazzled by all the wordplay and the imagery, and I appreciate you sharing it with all of us today.
My pleasure, Pat. Thank you so much for having me. It means a lot.
To find out more about Mighty Mike McGee, it's at Mighty Mike McGee at Instagram or MightyMikeMcGee.com. So go check him out. I love the spoken word model. Maybe it's because I like original material. I also love to see expression, people expressing themselves. My niece, Nicole Laffer is her name, and she, over the pandemic, had poems that she wanted to publish. And because I wasn't working, the stages were closed and the production was closed and all that, we decided to publish a book of her poems entitled Calling in Black. And I would love to have her, because she's really a spoken word artist. She really spends her time presenting her poetry live. And I don't know if you read that one, but I'd love her to read Calling in Black for us, because I find it's really got a great combination of personal point of view, and there's some activism in there as well. But it sort of just stirs your emotions.
Oh, it does. I read her book, Calling in Black, is fantastic. She's a great example of someone who done this with spoken word, but writes it down in a way where you can still get it on the page in a really powerful way.
We are now joined by Nicole Laffer in Wasilla, Alaska. How are things going there in Wasilla for poetry?
Things are going really well. There's a bookstore that I frequent called Black Birch Books. And so they host poetry events and have a really awesome selection of local authors and worldwide authors that they like to support.
And do you prefer writing poetry or presenting it in spoken word form?
I prefer the presentation of it. I feel like that way I can get the emotions that I want across better.
Well, I read on the back of your book a quote from the former poet laureate of Winona, Minnesota, Ken McCullough, and he talked about the book and said that there is strength in the poems, there's intimacy, there's self-confidence, there's vulnerability, and all of those things, innocence and maturity. And then he says, the poet is tough on us while being generous. Does that sound like a compliment?
I believe it is a compliment. There are certain poems in my book that really call us to arms to notice the world around us and do a step more than observation, but bring it to action.
Well, the book is called Calling in Black, and it was written under your previous name, Nicole Ramsey. And I'm wondering if you could share with us the title poem, Calling in Black, today.
This poem is just that. It's about needing a day off of work to come to terms with what is happening in the news, which I think is just as relevant today as it was when I wrote it 8 years ago. I am calling in black today, calling in woman. Last Sunday's daylight savings has made it dark by dinner. And as the chill hits my cheek, I confuse shadow with self and the ominous other. Allow fear to creep up my fingertips, too tense to continue a simple walk to the corner store. Wishing this was different than last week, last year. I am calling in black today, calling in woman, calling in exhausted from coworkers explaining their newfound belief in the reality of racism after seeing a textbook definition in the grocery store. Said nothing, did nothing, except remind me that my body is inherently thug and unceasingly slut, and even a humble existence is a fight for resistance. So I am calling in black today, calling in woman, calling in conflicted by being, breathing, wishing it was simple instead of this gradient-shaded system of disdain. Speaking well for a black girl creates an ingrained, untaught thought to hate our roots, our nose, and our slang. I am calling in black today, calling in woman. After all, Audre Lorde speaks of the innate necessity to love oneself as radical. And on my day off, I will perform the radical miracle of survival. Soon after my plea, the receiver goes silent, followed by a breathy laugh from my boss who informs me, you need to get your ass to work.
That's a powerful poem. Well, to find out more about Nicole Ramsey, you want to go to Amazon and look up this book, Calling in Black. Nicole Laffer now, formerly Nicole Ramsey.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity and to be along so many other poets.
If you were going to recommend to somebody, and I know this is a big ask, but if somebody wanted to pick up something that was accessible, is there a poet or a classic tome that you thought, what's the most accessible way for somebody to go, hey, I didn't know poetry could be so cool?
There's a few different places you can find good poems. There are a couple anthologies put out by Billy Collins called Poetry 180 and 180 More. His whole project, he was the United States Poet Laureate and had a project of you would read a poem to a class one a day for 180 days of school and just read the poem and not discuss it, just go on. So these are accessible, interesting, funny, serious poems. There's also a website, poetryoutloud.org, and it's a national program. In every state, high school students compete. It's got an anthology online of about 900 poems. All of them are meant to be open to students. So there's going to be a Shakespearean sonnet, and there's going to be a poem by Twyla Hanson, the former Nebraska State poet. Anything from poems that have been written 3 years ago to poems that have been written 500 years ago. So it's a real good mix, and they choose accessible poems there. There's a whole archive of a column that used to be in the newspapers, started by Ted Kooser when he was United States Poet Laureate, and carried on for a little bit by Kwame Dawes, who's a spectacular poet. And it's called American Life in Poetry. And you can look through the archives and find hundreds of poems that are meant to be just accessible and readable by a newspaper's average readers.
If you want to explore more of Matt Mason's poetry, go to midverse.com. That's MIDVERSE.com.
Hey, thank you so much, Pat. I mean, it's been a real inspiration listening to your show starting in the pandemic and on ever since. It's just such a great celebration of creativity.
Thanks for listening. Take a moment to subscribe and we will hold your seat for more creative conversation and a weekly spark of inspiration. Our show is produced by Sweetwood Creative in Austin, Texas, with sound editing and crafty co-producing by Tucker Hazel. The original music theme was created and sung by Maya Sharp, with additional production support and sanity provided by Diane Johansson, Tony Deo, and Tanner Dykstra. Please feel free to dash off a review on social media to help grow this creative community. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, or visit our website at creativityincaptivity.fun. You heard that right, .fun, as in dot was so fun. Bye for now.
Stage, a circus of uncertainty. Your call.